Hello and welcome back to the 2%, a podcast highlighting women who are breaking barriers and building the businesses of the future. Today, I'm thrilled to share a conversation with Ula co-founders, Adrienne and Elaine, who are on a mission to redesign maternity care from the ground up. Maternity care in the U.S. has been widely recognized as a systemic failure, with some of the highest maternal mortality rates in the world. Ula's Modern Maternity Center combines the best of obstetrics and midwifery care to deliver a more evidence-based and personalized pregnancy experience. From their collaborative medical team, welcoming clinic, and remote care platform, Ula is setting a new standard for pregnancy that unifies modern medicine and human intuition. There's a lot to cover, so let's get started. Okay. Welcome, Elaine and Adrienne. So excited to have you on here today and doubly excited since this is our first podcast with two co-founders. Let's just start with, how's it going today?
You know, I can't complain. It's a Friday afternoon. It's a little gray here in New York, but you know, the weather's still in the 50s, which I'll take.
Elaine?
Yeah, I'm doing great. Had one of my toddlers wake up from 2 to 4 last night, but you know, a couple cups of coffee, and I'm ready to be here.
Amazing. Well, just for context and background, you know, I think one of the things that we found so impressive when myself and the Female Founders Fund team met you both is really your deep healthcare backgrounds, which is relatively uncommon, you know, at the early stage, you know, for us as seed investors. And so would love for you both to maybe just share a little bit about your backgrounds prior to founding Ula and why you think that you're the right founders to really revolutionize maternal healthcare. Elaine, maybe you can start.
Yeah, happy to. So I started my career during the passage of the Affordable Care Act. Back in 2010, it was an awesome time to be in Washington, D.C. and think about what could really happen with our healthcare system and kind of some of the dire things that needed to change. But ultimately decided that policy was not really the place I wanted to be in. I was much more excited to be where policy was getting executed. So went on back to school at NYU, where I got my master's in healthcare administration, and on to consulting at Deloitte, which is where Adrienne and I met. I think both commiserated there a little bit because we were excited to work with, you know, a lot of what we thought innovative companies taking healthcare reform by the horns. And what we realized is that we were working with a lot of big hospital systems, big insurers. And while it was important to really understand what their incentives were, it was also hard to get these big kind of gorillas to move in the direction that we hoped that healthcare would move. So we both jumped ship. I went to a primary care startup called Privia Health. I was employee number 50 there. Privia is a network model, so they don't employ clinicians, but they aggregate them, give them tools and technology to drive better outcomes, and ultimately do better in what we call value-based care. So getting paid for those outcomes rather than just clicking a button or doing the work. I was then recruited by a company called CareMore Health, which I love to talk about because it's hugely influential in what Ula is today. CareMore is a $1.2 billion asset of Elevance, the big health insurance company. But it's really focused on end-of-life care and a geriatric patient population. What they really focused on was kind of bringing life elements to healthcare and recognizing that healthcare is not just about a narrow set of clinical needs. And when you think about end-of-life care, in this country, it's incredibly transactional when it's one of the most personal things that an individual or a family goes through. And what CareMore did was they thought about community. They had a loneliness program that brought their elderly patients together. They had gyms attached to their clinics. They had potluck suppers and marriages that happened between 90-year-old patients. It was really just this incredible place in healthcare. And I started saying, well, wait, why doesn't this apply to beginning of life care? I have to say I'm much happier to be in beginning of life care now, but really so many of the same principles apply, which is it's not a disease, it's a natural physiological event. And it's hugely transformative in an individual and their family's lives. And yet our healthcare system treats it like it's just another clinical disease and another, you know, service line if you work at a hospital. And so Adrian, I'll let Adrian give her background, and kind of why we came together as the perfect co-founders, we think, to really tackle this issue.
Amazing, thanks.
I love hearing your background each time, like, 'cause I'm just like, I'm so lucky to have you as a co-founder. It's so
I feel
badass.
the same.
But I can give mine. So I got into healthcare, similar to Elaine, that it has been sort of my whole career, but I started getting a master's in global health, focused on sexual and reproductive health. So in a lot of ways, I feel like Lula is the company I've been waiting my whole career to build. It's really how I got my start, focused on sort of the decision of when and why to have a kid. And I reflect a lot on this co-founder journey on why me and why doing this. And I feel like so much of my passion for the space I attribute to having grown up with three brothers. And so I think I love women's health, and particularly maternity care, because it's just one of the biggest inflection points women go through. And it's such a distinctly different experience than what most men go through. And so I think having sort of had that experience, it drives a lot of my interest. But I left grad school and was like, wow, that was like a wonderful experience to get to really dive deep and get to think about it all day. But it feels like to really build a business in the space, most of it is like kind of nonprofits or advocacy organizations working on this. And if I'm ever going to get to build what I think should exist, like I need to understand the business side of healthcare. And so I went to Deloitte and I did healthcare consulting. And as Elaine mentioned, that's where we met. And I did everything from like ICD-10 billing projects, which is like the nitty-gritty way that hospitals get paid, to opening new hospitals in Shanghai. So really the full stack of working in healthcare felt like I came away with sort of my MBA in healthcare economics from it. But also was convinced that big health systems and insurers weren't going to be the ones that were going to redefine or rebuild what care should look like, and wanted to get closer to honestly what was starting to happen more and more in New York, which were entrepreneurs were really building new and different things. And so I went to Northwell Health and their corporate venture arm, and sort of got to straddle between what all these new entrepreneurs were working on and trying to, pitch into the healthcare system, and what a hospital would actually be able to engage with and work with and sort of scale in their organization. And so it was a great crash course in sort of B2B to C, which is what so much of healthcare is. Like, you're crafting the value prop for the consumer and you're crafting a value prop for the person who's paying for it, and they're not the same thing. Loved getting to know all the entrepreneurs through that experience, and wanted sort of got the bug and wanted to do it myself. And so left and built something in the cancer care management space called Robin Care that took a really whole person approach to care. And similarly, Elaine and I were both sort of saying, wow, we're working in these spaces where we're applying this whole person approach and lens to it. Like, why aren't we doing it in women's health? And we were on the personal level, both again married, and we're starting to plan for our own families, and selfishly wanted to build the care experiences we wanted. And so got to do that with building Ula.
And one plug-in to add that I just can't nod. Adrian and I are mothers to three Ula babies, two of which were two of our first deliveries. And I think that's, one of the things that I'm most proud of in terms of our founder journey.
That's incredible. I love that. So, I think obviously we touched a little bit on your inspiration in starting Ula. As you looked at the opportunity, what was the vision? We obviously have a very specific reference point in terms of, you are pregnant, you go to the hospital, you deliver. There are different versions of what that experience can look and feel like, but as you were designing what you wanted Ula to feel like, and really how it differed, would love for you guys to maybe share on that, Adrian.
I think a part of what we started really in building the Ula journey was talking to everyone, honestly. Like, it was so clear it was broken, but we wanted to really understand, like, what was the root cause of it? And so we talked to, like, frankly, our friends and asked about their experiences. And I'd say generally you hear women talk about a really, like, transactional and impersonal and frankly sort of like factory assembly line approach. When you talk to insurance companies, they talk about how outcomes are just getting worse. So C-sections are really expensive. Preterm birth is really expensive. NICUs are really expensive. And the picture isn't looking better. And you talk to providers who work in it today, and they just talk about being burnt out and like hours being terrible and it being really unsustainable. And so at the kernel of all of that for us was the like realization that we just built the wrong care model. And that we'd created this infrastructure that required and put all of this pressure on this one-on-one relationship between an OBGYN and a patient, which is like giving everyone a surgeon and being like shocked that you get a lot of surgery on the other side of it. And so we really sort of went back to the basics and said, okay, well, if we know we don't like the outcomes, we know the care model's what's broken, where does it work well? And thankfully, there are lots of examples in which the rest of the world, frankly, have designed much better care experiences. And so we got to sort of borrow the best of both, and both what's working in the U.S. and what's working internationally, what the consumer here wants, and create what is the beautiful experience that is Ula today.
Amazing. Elaine, do you want to maybe just elaborate also on, even from a tactical standpoint, what can a potential Ula patient expect that would be, you know, different to a regular hospital experience?
Yeah, I think at the foundation of what we do is going back to kind of Adrian talking about our founding pathway, is what we realize is that you can't divorce experience and outcomes. And what experience means is a trusted conversation, authentic human connections. A horrible thing that what you look at is a maternal mortality review board. In most states, they have them. And when you actually dive into some of these cases, it all comes down to communication. It comes down to rushing patients through 10-minute prenatal care appointments, oftentimes a bad event in the delivery, and a lack of postpartum care. And what we really realized that we needed to focus on was how do we bolster the human connection? How do we use tech to make sure that our clinicians aren't focused on over-documentation, although that's incredibly critical to their job? How do we make sure that they have the right data during appointments so they can focus on what really matters to a patient? So I'll kind of walk through what like a traditional journey would look like if you were not an Ula patient, and then some areas where we've tweaked. So typically, according to ACOG, the pregnancy journey should be about 14 discrete appointments. And typically patients show up, oftentimes, this is what we've heard from those we surveyed, you wait an hour in the waiting room, you go in for 10 minutes, the doctor or, you know, clinician asks you, you know, any questions, what do you want to know? And people would walk out and say, well, I don't know, what do I need to know? I've never done this before. And so from that, we kind of thought about, we really need to build a curriculum. Because oftentimes with divorce is that the idea of education from the clinical journey. And by combining the two, it can be more of a learning experience, and it can drive the autonomy that we heard from women new families that they really wanted to get in their care journey. So if someone joins Ula, they have a first appointment, which is an intake appointment. That is twice as long as any intake appointment if you go to a regular OBGYN or other doctor's office. There, we're trying to understand your preferences. Do you have certain ideas for your birth plan? We really welcome the idea that a patient can have input and opinions on what they want their journey to look like. Then we have kind of this curriculum that lives in our technology, which patients can access throughout their journey. And they can also message their care team. So we have a virtual care team that's an extension of our midwives and OBs, for them to message questions in between. We also have a group element, which is really critical, and I love talking about with maternity care, because this is this really like isolating time. And you're wondering, what's happening to my body? What I'm going to come out of this journey? Am I going to be the same person? Like, what is my identity? And bringing together groups while going through this, whether it's kind of similar due dates, it's really important to get patients to ask each other questions and feel like they have peers along the way. When it comes to delivery, so we deliver at Mount Sinai West, which is an amazing New York City hospital. We have midwives on call there 24/7. So if any patient walks into Mount Sinai, there is an Ula midwife. And that's where our deliveries. But that's not where things end. And when you compare it to the traditional system, basically patients get a six-week appointment and then you wave goodbye and hope everything's okay. And at the same time, this is where so many of the complications happen, whether it's hemorrhaging, which is a very clinical thing that can occur and has horrible outcomes. Whether it's things like breastfeeding, incontinence, lack of sleep, I mean, you name it, there are partner issues. I mean, you're literally there's two new identities that come out of when you have a baby on the other side. And what is the support as individuals are navigating this? And so this is where we've also applied one-on-one as well as group care, where we have postpartum circles where individuals join and they can drop in. There's a doula and a lactation consultant. It's virtual, and they can talk to one another and understand what's going on. Also, talk to a specialist to help them with latching, sleep, feeding, etc. But if you talk to anyone who's gone through a traditional pathway, this experience piece is completely divorced, as well as the education. We felt like we had to bring it all together into one. Adrian, anything you'd add to my journey explanation?
No, I think you hit on all the highlights.
Yeah, I think also, just the human part of it is really what strikes me. And I'd love to maybe just chat a little bit more about the doulas, because obviously, doula is very much derived, I think, from the care that and the care system that doulas have, historically provided for literally hundreds, if not thousands of years. And so how does the midwifery aspect of this play into your care model?
Well, I love talking about our name in the first place, right? To which you point out, like Ula very much is paying homage to the word doula. And we love that because doulas are the one person in the room where their entire job is to focus on the mom. And with so much of the sort of maternity care system in this country oriented on the baby, we sort of forget that the mom is also a person that matters. And so in building a company that really wanted to elevate women's voices in their care and say that that autonomy was really important, we wanted to pay homage for it in the name. And then the way it actually manifests doula can look in a few different ways, right? We have, to your point, midwives who are obviously different than doulas, right? Midwives are, trained clinicians, experts at low-risk care, but they elevate a lot of the things that are great about doulas, right? They are taking a whole person approach to care. They're focusing on, mind, body, and soul, as Elaine says so elegantly, and how they support women during this journey. And so we love that aspect of it. We also hire doulas specifically into our care coordination team. So much of what happens in pregnancy care happens outside of, those 14 visits. It happens in all of the moments in between when you realize you have questions or you have concerns or you just need to talk to someone. And so we have doulas as part of our care coordination team because we think they're the best at being sort of air traffic control and care concierges and folks who support both in that postnatal space or in the prenatal space and definitely into postpartum where all of life sort of collides with the new baby you have. And so incorporating both sort of midwives and doulas in the model is really just core to the philosophy of building a doula in the first place, which is you need to take a whole person approach to pregnancy care. It isn't a clinical condition only. It really is this life event that women are going through.
Yeah, no, I think that I love that. And I remember when we first started chatting, one of the interesting aspects of the business model was also that, these doulas are also bringing their own patients in a sense, because for them, there's obviously upside and opportunity in being part of your network, which is, I think, such a fundamental advantage that you have in your business model.
Yeah, I think it was so wonderful, honestly, the reception from the birth community, like broadly, right? So the doulas, the midwives, the acupuncturists, the lactation consultants, everyone has been so supportive because I think they're aligned with what we see, which is that this is why the way that care should be delivered in this country. This is what derives the best experience and outcomes for women. And so majority, when we think of like where do patients hear about us and how do they find us in the first place? Doulas and sort of that birth community is an incredible source of referrals into the business and the thing that continues to make us so proud is that the fact that women are having a great experience just continues to power that flywheel of getting word of mouth referrals and provider referrals and people really feeling like this is the answer to the problems in this country related to maternity care.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. And, you know, just along those lines, obviously, I think many people are aware that women delivering birth in America today are 50% more likely to die in childbirth or from childbirth-related complications than their mothers were, which is just insane. And so, you know, being within healthcare, Elaine, I'm curious, you know, what's contributing to this? How did this kind of evolve to the place where we are now? Would love to hear your point of view.
Yeah, and I'll go back to the fact that fundamentally we believe that you cannot divorce experience and outcomes. I think Adrian and other maternal health experts would agree, a lot of it comes down to time. And yes, time is money. You know, every dollar, every minute that a clinician spends with their patient amounts to capital. But at the same time, we need to really expand upon those appointment times, also use technology to make sure that we're touching patients in between those appointments. But that lack of time results in patients being pushed through prenatal care, doctors not and clinicians not really understanding what those patients' needs are, and then moving into a model where they're actually incentivized to intervene more. As Adrian mentioned, it's not surprising. When you give everyone a surgeon, it's not surprising there's a lot of surgeries. On top of that, for a while in American maternal health care, we pay more for C-sections than vaginal deliveries. That's starting to change. But if you think about it, someone's going through a prenatal care journey. Their doctor doesn't know anything about them. They get to the delivery where a lot of the complications happen. And the clinician is looking at the clock. And not necessarily that clinicians are thinking about, you know, dollars and cents as they're catching babies. But, you know, there might be an incentive for them to get to their, you know, golf tee time. I mean, it's not unusual to actually see in the data that C-sections spike on Friday afternoons and Friday evenings. And some of that is related to the fact that there is an incentive for clinicians to get out of the hospital onto their lives. And there's different interventions to do that. And so as we started looking at it, we think a lot about slowing down the process. How do we make sure that there are conversations? Very few times, and they do exist, but very, very few times do you have to make a decision in an absolute split second. And as a result, we want to make sure that the patient is really part of those conversations and can give their perspective on what they want their care journey to look like, whether that's in the delivery room, prenatal care, or postpartum. And so when you go back to statistics and you go back to what's wrong in the maternal healthcare system, it's this lack of time and pushing patients through and not having the time to have those authentic conversations and connections that we feel is really driving the abysmal outcomes that we see today.
That makes sense. Adrian, I'm curious, you know, from your perspective, call it, you know, 50 or 60 years, maybe less since, you know, our moms gave birth. Are there any specific shifts, cultural shifts, or even economic shifts that you think have contributed to this desire to kind of just move people through the system? Anything that you can pinpoint?
You know, I might actually talk about a different shift that I'm seeing, which is the consumer actually looking for something different, which I think is so fascinating as what has changed from sort of the consumer today versus like our parents. And part of it is that you're just seeing women approach their care saying, I don't always want the first thing to be offered to me to be like a pill, a procedure, or a test. And so I think you're really seeing consumers drive a different sort of drive, like, or create the pressure for change and drive something like Ula to be successful, where we're doing something new and different, right? That hasn't been the status quo in the United States really almost ever, but particularly since sort of midwives were forced out of the workforce as a result of sort of male doctors professionalizing obstetrics as a, like a hospital-based approach. And so I think what has been interesting to watch happen over even the past couple decades is just this shift in consumer sentiment. I think it's what drives Ula to be successful. It's what allows the care model in the first place to be really adopted and engaged for by our consumers. And so I'm not sure like the, like it's hard to sort of tease underlying that, like is the consumer also being driven to want this model because they're watching outcomes get worse? And I think that's probably a piece of it too, right? They're seeing C-section rates go up, they're seeing preterm birth rates go up, and they're savvy and they're sort of looking for something different. But I think it's all of the same sort of things that have always been true about our healthcare system that just continue to get worse, which is why we see outcomes continuing to get worse, which is we're only pushing providers to see folks in shorter and shorter amounts of time in this fee-for-service environment that doesn't reward time spent with patients. We're seeing continued sort of pressure on our clinical workforce to have to figure out how to serve patients in fewer and fewer time because there are fewer and fewer doctors out there and we're not training more of them. So I think it's like the same dynamics. They've just been continuing to get worse decade over decade, but they've driven this great change in just the consumer and what they're demanding and what they're looking for in their care.
Yeah, I guess it's both sides.
Yeah.
I always say too, we've literally been doing this since the beginning of time. Like that's inherent in birth. And so what makes us think that we have to constantly intervene in something that is this natural physiological event? And yes, there's advances in modern medicine that have really helped with a lot of the quality in pregnancy care. But I think a major light bulb when Adrian and I were doing our year, 2 years of research on this was that some of these interventions is actually what's causing the distress to the maternal healthcare system. And there's a balance that we really need to achieve where we're only intervening in times that are necessary and with that patient's consent.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes sense. Such great points. And, you know, so glad that Ula is around today and I think really making a lot of progress in shifting what that kind of status quo looks like for women. You know, I think one interesting point that, again, came up, you know, in the early days of our conversations was around the fact that Black women are almost four times as likely to die from childbirth complications than white women in America. And so I know that both of you were very intentional in the early days of addressing this. Elaine, do you want to maybe share a little bit about that?
Yeah, definitely. And actually, it's core to one of the reasons that we chose to launch in New York. So in the United States more broadly, I think most people know now that Black women are three times more likely to die than white women in childbirth. And what's even worse is that even more recent data has shown that even if they go to the exact same hospitals, they still see worse outcomes. It has actually nothing to do with socioeconomic status. It has to do with racism. And in New York City, Black women are 12 times more likely. And so there was this really moral impetus for us to try to tackle this in New York. And you know, what is it about New York that makes it worse? And sometimes it goes back to, it's probably the hustle. It's probably that you have to move patients as quickly as possible through the healthcare system in order to turn a dime. And so that's one of the major reasons we focused on the midwifery model of care and slowing things down. There's also a reason, you know, midwives themselves are actually proven to be really effective at improving these maternal mortality statistics among BIPOC patients. There's also a lot of research on group therapy and doulas. And so this evidence is really at the core of how we designed our care model. The other thing that we really think about is how do we build a diverse team that reflects the patient population that we want to see? And so sadly, as Adrian mentioned, there's a real interesting history with midwives in this country. They actually started off primarily being individuals of color. And then when obstetrics were really brought into this kind of the current medical construct, they were really dispelled from the system. And as a result, in the United States, only about 78% of midwives are actually identified as individuals of color. And so at Ula, above 20% of our midwives are those that identify as individuals of color. And we have a specific program where we're also focused on training midwives of color is part of trying to get more into our healthcare system, because there's so much data that shows that when clinicians look like the patients that they serve, they have better outcomes. We also do a lot of training with our team members. We use a platform called Violet, which is about delivering culturally competent care. Again, just trying to make sure that we are really seeing the patients that we take care for and understand some of the challenges they face that may be inherently related to their race and ethnicity.
That's amazing. And I love, it's so important, I think, to integrate that into your culture from the early days, because it's so hard to instill that as a core value after the fact. And I've heard, even anecdotally that you guys have done an incredible job on that front. So that's really impressive. So we're now a couple years into the journey. I'm curious, what's happened since launch. What are the results? Any exciting or notable trends that you've seen? Any lessons learned, Adrian?
Well, first of all, I have to shout out the over 1,100 babies we've delivered, because
Amazing.
that feels
Amazing.
like the most tangible sort of results
Yeah,
that we're
I love that.
putting out into the world. And I love to watch. So we give patients Oola onesies, and it's so fun to watch them. First of the first of all, whoever wears something they get from a doctor's office, like the fact that our patients are so proud to put their most precious thing in the world into Oola swag and share it with the world, I think just speaks to how deeply we've built connections with women and the birthing people who come to us. And so we're proud of that. Obviously, in sort of brass tacks, we're an evidence-based org, and so we're tracking numbers. And so beyond obviously the beautiful babies and the Oola onesies, we're obsessive about experience. It goes back to Elaine's comment earlier that you can't divorce experience from outcomes. They're so intertwined, and particularly in something like pregnancy care. And so we have an NPS score of 94, which I just sort of want to drop the mic there, because I don't know what healthcare
Amazing.
companies can tout that. And that's, years in, thousands of patients responding. So really robust at this point. But on top of that, we're healthcare organs, so we're looking at our clinical outcomes. And so we're looking at both that for mom and baby. And so tracking ourselves against C-section rates and low birth weight babies, which are, one of the biggest indicators that they're going to go to the NICU, and preterm birth rates. And across the board, we're better than benchmark and only getting better. And what I think, going back to the conversation we just had on sort of racial disparities in care, we disaggregate our outcomes, right? We look at them by race, and we look at them also by whether you're on commercial insurance or Medicaid, and we see the improvements across the board. And so we're really proud that we've built a care model that doesn't just sort of serve the average patient, it serves the folks who are in most need of better care in this country.
Amazing. I love that. Elaine, anything to add just in terms of surprises? It's so interesting. Often you raise money, you're excited to launch a business, you launch it, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh wow, did not expect this, surprise. Anything come to mind along those lines?
Yeah, it's honestly awesome to be an Oola mom and the co-founder of Oola in the Brooklyn community. The other week I was at my toddler son's curriculum night, and I saw one of our earliest patients. She had no idea who I was, but Adrian and I actually worked the front desk for the first couple of weeks, mostly because we were crazy about finding the right first front desk person, because they're kind of like the front door to Oola. But also it was actually an incredible experience for us to really understand our patient population, what their needs were, why they came to Oola, et cetera. But I saw this patient and I said, are you an Oola patient? And she gave me this huge smile, not knowing who I was, but she pulled out her Oola water bottle and she said, yes, and who are you? Are you an Oola patient? I said, yeah. And then, I'm also the co-founder. And then two other parents overheard me say that. And one dad said, oh, my wife's an Oola patient. And another one said, oh, my friend's an Oola patient. And it was just this incredible moment of being like, yes, we have had an impact on this community that really transcends beyond the four walls of our clinic. And really, it's this kind of culture that we've built around pregnancy care and beyond. And one thing I love to talk about in terms of and beyond is that our patients are literally begging us to do more. So we surveyed our patients, and 92% of them responded that they were dying for us to do gyne care. They didn't want to go back to the existing healthcare system.
Wow.
So we're trying to get more and more tidbits from our patients of what they're looking for. But the stickiness and really the pride that they have of being an OULA patient is probably one of the most surprising but incredible parts of being a co-founder of this business.
Oh, I love that. That's, you know, especially all of them, you know, in the same room. That's
yeah.
Incredible. So we can switch gears a little bit and talk about, you know, I think everyone's favorite topic at the moment, fundraising. So, you know, obviously you guys have raised a seed, and, you know, several rounds after that. And, you know, particularly I would say the last 18 months have been incredibly challenging. Would love to maybe just hear you guys chat about your fundraising journey and how that's evolved. And, Adrienne.
I like to say it's getting easier each time, or at least that's what I tell myself, probably because we kicked off our fundraise for that seed round in April of 2020. And if anyone remembers what they were doing in April of 2020, they were probably sheltering in place. And so going out to raise capital for a brick and mortar business was an interesting endeavor, I have to say, at that moment in time. I also, on the flip side of that, in some ways, so happy we went out to do it at that point, because I think we also just got incredible investors around the table. We got folks who really could sort of sift through the noise, think critically about the business, understand why there was such a compelling need and why there's an incredible business opportunity behind it. And so I think we got really great investors around the table, Female Founders Fund included, back when we raised the seed round. And, you know, we have an incredible team at OULA, right? We walked through our backgrounds at the beginning. We spent a lot of time in healthcare, but that's true throughout the organization, right? We have lots of folks who have incredible depth in building healthcare services businesses. And so I think at each round of capital we've gone out to raise, we've just shown how much we've been able to hit it out of the park and just execute. And like that has really helped businesses sort of live and die in healthcare services. It's usually not a product market fit question. It's an execution game. And mm-hmm. So being able to go out for, you know, the Series A and other rounds of capital, being able to show incredible data, right? To be able to show healthcare outcomes in like your first year and a half of a business is huge. To be able to show a sustainable business model with incredible unit economics in the environment in which people seem to have forgotten that you had to like build an actual good business has paid, you know, dividends for us. And so while fundraising is never fun, I think particularly sometimes as a female founder, I think it's getting easier and easier as we have just been able to show that this is the model that works and that the business model scales. I don't know. Elaine, anything you'd add?
Yeah, I would just say how fortunate we feel about having a lot of strong women around our cap table. And I'm not just saying this because this is a Female Founders Fund podcast, but I would love to talk about how important the Female Founders Fund community has been to us. I think Adu knows this, but I went to all-girl school for about 8 years, and I feel like I'm at home when I go to a Female Founders Fund event. I mean, this podcast is obviously named the 2% for a reason. I hope at some point we get to change the name. Maybe it gets to 5% podcast or 10% podcast in the next couple of years. But we have really unique challenges we face as female entrepreneurs, as mothers who are entrepreneurs. And I've had so many incredible conversations with other entrepreneurs and other founders in the female founder community about the unique challenges that we have. I'm just so, so grateful to be a part of it.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. I guess along those lines, you know, obviously we're on the 2% podcast, and part of what we're doing with this is really highlighting stories of founders and individuals who are working to improve these stats. And so curious, you know, from both of your perspective, what do you think it will take to get parity? Maybe Adrian, you can start.
Ooh, that's a good one, but a tough one. I think on some level, why even am I an entrepreneur in the first place? And like, why do I care about having a great exit? I think it's to be able to put more money in behind other women. And so I think the thing that is going to continue to change the game is having more women writing checks, having more founders have great exits, and those folks continuing to sort of fund and reach an arm down to like the next group of founders and lift them up. And so I don't think it's a thing that unfortunately that's going to like change overnight, but I think it's going to change by more and more women having the money and the power to drive the change.
Yeah, no, I agree.
I couldn't agree more. Couldn't agree more. I would just emphasize, our business isn't about making money. Like, our business is about changing maternity care. And yes, it would be a fantastic side product of making capital off of it. But that's what really is about driving change, I think, in the venture capital industry, is to show that this is not, female-founded companies aren't charities to invest in. They have real returns. And statistics show that actually diverse founding teams have better returns. And it feels like for some reason, most venture capitalists, even though they see that data, they don't believe in it. And so we just have to keep proving them over and over again by continuing to build these really robust, financially sustainable businesses.
Yeah, I really couldn't agree more. So we're going to move into our lightning round now. And I'm going to go between both of you, basically just answer with whatever comes to mind first. Elaine, maybe we can start with you. What gets you out of bed in the morning?
The toss up. Is it my 4-month-old or is it my 2-month-old? I mean, 2-year-old.
Adrian, if you weren't the founder of Ula Now, what would you be doing?
You know, I love building things. And so I'd just be the founder of something else. It is sort of the thing that even when Ula is wonderful, successful, and we exit, I'll just be like, unfortunately, doing it all over again, because it is just a crazy and wild journey. And you have to be a little bit insane, I think, to be a founder, but I love it. But, piggybacking on Elaine's comment about, you know, her toddlers waking her up, maybe my next company will be something around like sleep training, because I feel like there's a huge opportunity in that space that has not been fully tapped.
Especially sleep training with a target demographic of female executives, because I'm finding we're almost too tired to actually get to the sleep training. And so how do you take that unique demographic that needs sleep so much?
The most. So Elaine, if you could talk to one person, from history, who would that be and why?
Oh, such a great question. I would have to say Queen Elizabeth, and not just because I am a Crown fan, which I am an addict when I find the time. But I just think there's just awesome lessons in female leadership, and that's in her life. And I have loved watching that on Netflix.
Adrian, anything you want to plug or announce here?
Well, I definitely want to shout out our third clinic that we just announced with Sinai that's opening on 112th Street, so Morningside Heights, in the beginning, so I guess sort of midway through next year. And also we're hiring a ton. Like, we are growing and growing and growing in 2024. So if you want to work for an incredibly mission-driven, fast-growing startup, we probably have a role for you. Reach out.
And where can our listeners find you both online? Elaine?
www.ulahealth.com.
And on Instagram?
What is our Instagram now? Ula Health.
I think what Elaine is pointing out is that neither of us are big on social. I'm to the point that I think I only have an Instagram account to follow other food accounts so I know what to cook for dinner. I'm like the anti-social media person, and so sadly it is only through the Ula channels.
Yes, exactly. Thank you for calling it out. And that was evidenced by when I met one of our patients who had no idea who I was. There's a reason behind that. We think that our clinical team, our team speaks for themselves. And we want our patients to get to know them as much as they're getting to know us.
I love that. Well, it's been such a pleasure having you both on, and so appreciate your time. I know, a lot going on, and yeah, can't wait to get this out there. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you. This was fun.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you for tuning into the 2% for today's episode featuring Ula co-founders Adrian and Elaine. Their dedication to reimagining the maternity care model is incredibly inspiring, and we're thrilled to include Ula as a Female Founders Fund portfolio company. Stay in touch with us on Instagram at Female Founders Fund and on Twitter at FQVC. And for those of you building the next billion-dollar businesses, we'd love to hear from you. Send all pitch decks to pitches@femalefoundersfund.com and we'll be in touch. And finally, if you're interested in working at one of our 45-plus female-founded startups, explore our job opportunities at jobs.femalefoundersfund.com.